Good evening.
Good evening.
It is wonderful to see all of you. As people trickle in, I know we may be a little bit low in number, but I always say I believe God is very intentional.
Yes,
and He's very present, and I believe before this evening is over, my prayer and my hope is that the Lord will just touch you, will open your hearts, will open your minds, will deposit something very precious in you to take away with, to even be transformative. We want to welcome you to the gathering. This is something, is a new set of series that we've started here at VCF. Some of you have been part of this already in the prior cycle, but we're kicking off this evening a new series on the topic of what it means to live every season fully. And it's a topic that's very dear to my heart, and I think something that everybody can relate to. For those of you who may not know me, maybe two or three that I don't know very well, my name is Sanjeev. I have been going to VCF for now almost about 14 years, and I am married. I have a wonderful wife and two children. They've been married for about 5 years, and have two young kids, and I get to be a doctor at Kaiser during the daytime, and a family medicine doctor. I've been in practice for about 15 years or so, and so, you know, I preach here at VCF from that time to time, and my wife will always tell me, you need to preach more and you need to teach less. So tonight, I actually get to teach and preach less. So this is a passion of mine. I for me, I always love it when people take like difficult concepts and break it down and present it to me in ways that really stick. And so a passion of mine is always trying to take difficult things and breaking it down. And if I can get it, then I think most everybody else can get it. So hopefully you will find these next few weeks to be very fruitful and very meaningful. I want to turn your attention real quick to kind of just give you guys the broad overview of what to expect. If you look in this little brief two-page handout, you'll kind of see the next few weeks laid out for you. Starting with today's session, today being October 24th, and we will be meeting every Thursday evening, moving forward, all the way through December 12th, Thursday, with the exception being Thanksgiving Thursday, which is the 28th. We will not be getting together on that day. And for the first three sessions, you're stuck with me teaching. And then you will have way more capable teachers and profound men of faith. Pastor Ko, Jihan, Pastor Mubanga, they're going to be teaming up to help lead the final few sessions. And as you see here, session four, which will be on November 14th, will be sort of a time for your individual small groups to have dinner together and have an outing or activity. So there won't be any formal teaching that 1 week, but all the other weeks expect there to be formal teaching. I've been praying through what the Lord had for us. And oftentimes, you know, when I wait upon the Lord, He has a way of sometimes giving me things I want to avoid. You know, I've read the Bible through from front to back. And historically, I'll confess to you, I have sort of kind of skimmed and fast-forwarded through certain sections. with certain sections in the Old Testament especially, where I kind of gloss over, I read all the commentaries. I will dive into bits and pieces, but maybe through the genealogies and the orders and the Levitical codes and so forth and so on, I might kind of go through it a little bit faster. But the Lord just kept bringing me back to the book of Numbers. And I kind of grew up thinking about this book as sort of a historical book with details, with maybe a few themes here and there. But I'll freely submit to you, in this season of studying and preparing for this, the Lord has just really brought up the richness in this book. It's a book that a lot of people think is dry and not as relevant and not as exciting and not as engaging, but the Holy Spirit's just been kind of bringing forth all sorts of revelation as I'm reading through it. And I hope I'll be able to guide you through that journey as we dive into this book. There's a number of chapters in this book, and depending as I look around, let me just get a flavor for, if you guys don't mind disclosing, is there anybody younger than the age of 22? How old are you?
21.
21.
22 in January.
22. Okay, so you are the youngest in our group. And who are our elder states people here?
States women.
Okay. Would you mind disclosing roughly where you are, age-wise?
Age-wise?
Yes.
Approaching 80.
Wow.
Not there yet.
Wow.
Who else is in their 20s? Show of hands. Okay. Who else is in their 30s? Okay. Anyone in their 40s? Any 50s?
Skip.
60s? Okay. 70s?
Approaching.
Okay, so outside of 50s and 70s, we have almost every other decade represented. Very good. So, in taking a look at the topic of what it means to live every season fully, I want us to ask the question this evening, what is a season, right? Have you ever thought about that? What exactly is a season? And how do we define it? You know, growing up, if you guys are a fan of pop culture, you know about a group named The Byrds, and you would hear that famous song, "To every turn, 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 there is a season." You know the song. You know, loosely based on Ecclesiastes 3, right, where the writer talks about there's a time for everything and a season for every activity under the sun, a time to be born, a time to die, a time for war, a time for peace. And the writer of Ecclesiastes kind of goes through the fact that God has sort of an intended and apportioned time for different activities to take place in all our lives, in different time periods. And so I've loosely thought about this, that as you read through Scripture, there's this mention of season, season, season. And you know, I think a lot of times the way we function with regard to seasons is we let society kind of define seasons for us, right? So we think, all right, there is somebody who's a kid. He's in his season of being a child. And then teenage years has its own season. And then, you know, all the things that stereotype a teenager these days. And then there's the young adult season, right? Where young adult, working, student, college. We have Pasadena City College over here. And oftentimes people think of that student season as a season in itself. And then you got the young adult who's starting to work. And then maybe society tells us the next season is, you know, when you potentially are single and about to get married. And then you get married. And marriage is a whole new season. We have a lot of newlyweds here in our church. And then you move into maybe having children. And we also have a lot of folks here at BCF now who have a lot of young kids. And there's that season of new parenthood. And then society tells us maybe you go into sort of this midlife crisis in your 40s and early 50s. And then maybe you become empty nesters. like our pastor, although his kids keep coming back. And then, you know, you age on into the society tells us there's this thing called Medicare at 65. And then you go from, and you retire from work at 65. A couple decades ago, 55 used to be the retirement age. Now it's 65. And then, you know, there was an interesting study I'll just share with you that came out in several journals. So they looked at how many, so you know when people save up for a pension, right? And so a lot of folks work till 65 to kind of maximize their pension. Some even go longer. But they took, nationally in the U.S., they took these two groups of people, people who retired at 58 and people who retired at 65, right? Because if you retire at 58, 58 and a half, 59, you can kind of apply for early retirement, get some benefits, and get your 401 plans kicked in. Or you can wait till 65 to kind of maximize the pension you get. Well, studies show people who retired at 58 and a half, do you know how much, for how many years they wound up getting pension checks before they died? Just a random question. How long?
30?
30? Okay. Any other guesses?
Yes.
So 20 years.
Oh.
20 is very close. Oh. Yeah. So people who retired at age 58 wound up living on average in the U.S. another 17 years. Okay. So they had still a good chunk of time still left to enjoy the fruits of their labor, right? Now, people who retired at 65, what do you think is the average age they live up to in the U.S.?
21.
85.
Oh, I'm sorry.
21
more years.
That number is actually shocking. I'll give you a clue.
10. 25.
10 years? Keep going.
30.
This is the average.
17.
Try lower.
Say.
Try lower.
Wow. 5.
Try lower.
2?
Try. You said 2?
Yeah.
Try lower.
Oh, really?
18 months.
Oh, yes.
So the person in the U.S. that today retires, who retires at 65, on average, this is throughout all of the U.S. You take all the sick people and all the healthy people, they get a pension check for 18 more months before they pass away.
Wait, 18 more than the people?
At age 65, they die at 67 on average, okay? So three different studies actually came to the same conclusion. I share this with you because everybody kind of lives this dream, right? I'm going to work hard until I'm 65 to maximize my benefits, and then I'll spend the rest of my life going on cruises and sailing the world and living it up. And yet reality tells us that people on average are living 18 months to get paychecks after they pass away at 67 to 68. Whereas people who retire earlier actually wind up living 17 years on average longer. So there's something about the culture here, the way we work, especially kind of in that time period, like 58 to 65, where our bodies are starting to wear down, but oftentimes our level of stress and responsibilities are actually quite the highest in that time period. Because oftentimes through work, you've kind of just established yourself, and now you're in managerial and supervisory positions, and you're dealing with all that stress and all that anxiety and all that responsibility, and then you retire, and then 18 months later, you're gone. So this kind of has shaken up the medical community, because we get all this data, and now as physicians, we're trying to process how the heck are we going to counsel our patients to live differently.
Wow.
Right? And it made me think, at the age of 41, how am I living my life? How am I living this season? And it's just food for thought. As a doctor, when I think of seasons, I also put people in boxes, right? If you come into my office when you're in your 20s, I will recommend certain things for you to get checked. Your cholesterol, your diabetes levels, give you some counseling on weight. If you come to me in your 30s, you know, for women, we'll be doing pap smears. In your 40s, mammograms. In your 50s, we're doing colonoscopies. In your 60s, you're getting certain vaccines and bone density scans. And then after 65, we can give you a certain way. And after 80, we stop doing a lot of the screening things because we figure if you've made it this far, everything else is bonus. So as a doctor, I think about life seasons a certain way based on what we know about the human body. If you walk among spiritual circles and churches, a lot of times people will tell you, well, you know what, I think about seasons in the same way God has provided nature for us. There is winter, there is spring, there is fall, there is summer. A lot of folks will say, well, you know what, I think about spring is when God does new things, new beginnings. And I think about fall, as summer, as a time to kind of work hard. And I think about fall as maybe a time when I reap, I harvest the fruits of my labor. And maybe I think about winter as a season when things start to die down and fade and there's closure to things. And so you'll hear the seasonal analogy of the calendar when it comes to spiritual seasons. And yet others in churches will talk about seasons like, well, you know, you're in this season of dryness where not much seems to be happening spiritually. Or maybe you're in this season of poverty where you just aren't getting any resources. Or you're in this season of trials where it just seems like you're getting pounded with one test after another. Or you are sort of in a season of joyful bliss where everything seems to be going well for you right now. So there's all sorts of ways people define seasons, okay? And I am purposely not going to define the season for you right now, but I just want you to think about it because I'm hoping by the end of this series, you are going to be able to come up with your definition of what a season truly is. Okay? Food for thought. So keep that question in your mind as we go through the next few weeks. What is truly a season? Now, I'll give you a clue. Merriam-Webster, the dictionary folks, give a very simple definition of a season. They call it a time characterized by a particular circumstance or feature. Pretty simple. A season is a time characterized by a particular circumstance or a feature. Sounds simple enough. I would submit to you, kind of use that as a baseline, but I would hope you will be able to richly add to that definition by the time our course ends. I want us to think about seasons as we dive into the book of Numbers. Actually, the Lord gave me the theme first, and I was actually writing and praying into the season of singleness for me before I got married, because I was single for a long time, and then I only got married at the age of 36, and so by societal standards, for some, that's kind of late, and so I had a lot of time to think about the value of my singleness season. And as I prayed into it, the Lord just began to kind of expand what it meant to not just live in that season of singleness, but how he might actually have fruit in every season and where those principles I gained during that season of singleness, how that could actually be applicable to every different season of life. And so first God gave me the theme, and then I never expected it to go in the direction of Numbers, but here we are. The book of Numbers is, as you know, it's the fifth book in the Old Testament attributed to Moses. If Genesis tells the story of the creation and the flood and how God set up the original covenant with his faithful servant Abraham and kind of established a covenant relationship with mankind and said that he will cause the seeds of Abraham to shine greater than the stars in the sky or the specks of sand on the ocean in terms of the descendants and his people and how God would use that covenant relationship with man through the faithfulness of his servant Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and all the 12 tribes of Israel that came. If Genesis tells that story, and then the second book of Exodus tells the story of how God's people were delivered from the hands of Pharaoh in Egypt after 400 years of slavery, and then you go into Leviticus where God hands his people some laws to live by for worship and righteous living, we come to the book of Numbers, and Numbers tells the historical narrative of how people, now free from slavery, now out of Pharaoh's control, now freed and in from Mount Sinai, how their journey looks like from that point all the way to the promised land in Canaan that God, several hundred years ago, had promised to Abraham. And so the time period we're entering is about 1400 BC, roughly. Okay, God's people have been delivered out of slavery in Egypt, and they find themselves in Mount Sinai. And I want for you guys to take 5 minutes to watch a little video clip. I don't know about y'all, but I am very picture-based, and I like visual stuff, and I like broad overviews before we dive into the deep details. So I looked at the internet, and I actually looked at like 40 different sites, and I think this is the best video out there that sums up the book of Numbers. So in 5 minutes, watch carefully, you're going to get a whole summation of the entire book in a very creative, animated way. So thank you, Daniel, for downloading it. Let's have a look.
The book of Numbers gets overlooked, partly because it has a really boring name.
Which is a shame. In the Hebrew tradition, the book's name is Bamidbar, which means in the wilderness. And it's an epic travelogue about Israel's journey through the desert on their way to the land promised to Abraham.
Now, this pilgrimage should only take about 2 weeks on foot.
But instead, it takes them about 40 years.
That's crazy. It's practically half of someone's lifetime.
Yeah, it's a very long camping trip with lots of interesting stories, but let's remember, it's most helpful to back up and start with how this book is designed.
Right.
So the book is broken up into 5 sections. There are 3 wilderness locations, broken up by 2 road trips that link all the pieces together.
The first wilderness section is Mount Sinai, right here on the map.
And then in the second section, they travel to a region called Paran.
A whole bunch of things happen here in the wilderness of Paran.
And then in this fourth section is Israel's road trip to Moab.
The book ends with a large section in the wilderness of Moab, right across the Jordan River from the Promised Land.
Now, through all of these sections, the storyline just flows like a gripping dramatic movie. Everything starts great, but then the trip goes horribly wrong, and it all ends with the final redemptive moment, the surprising act of God's grace.
So let's jump into the story. It all begins at the wilderness at Mount Sinai, and we've become really familiar with this mountain.
Yeah, if you remember, Israel came here after Egypt, and they formed a covenant with God here, got the Ten Commandments here, built the tabernacle here, and they've been at this mountain for one full year.
And now they take a census to number the people as they prepare to leave.
Right, and they're given these instructions for how to organize all those people in the camp. God's presence in the tabernacle, and then the tribe of Levi and the priests around it, and then the rest of the tribes around them. And this pattern, it's this visual symbol for how God's holiness is at the center of their existence as a people.
And they're told that when the cloud of God's presence moves, they're to pack up and travel with it.
Yeah, the Ark of the Covenant is carried by the Levites out in front, and then the tribe of Judah, and on and on. And this order is also a symbol for how God's holy presence is their leader and guide through the wilderness.
We begin the second section of the book with enthusiasm as they leave Mount Sinai and travel up the Paran. God's with them, everything's organized. This is going to be great.
But it's not great. After just 3 days on the road, the people are complaining about their hunger and thirst, and then even Moses' brother and sister start bad-mouthing him in front of all the people.
Not a great start. But now we're into the third section, the wilderness of Paran. This is where they send the 12 spies to scout out the promised land. Two of those spies come back, and they're really optimistic.
But the other 10 are freaked out, and they don't trust God, and they go around saying, we're going to get annihilated in there. And so they start a mutiny, and they try to appoint a new leader who's going to take all the people back to Egypt. And so basically, they are refusing to go into the promised land, and God honors their choice. He says that this generation is going to wander for 40 years and die in the wilderness, and only their kids will get to enter the promised land.
You know, this story here gets brought up many times in the Bible by different authors.
Yeah, and it always serves as a reminder that while God remains faithful to his people and his promises, he will honor their choices. He'll let them waste their whole lives if they choose to live in rebellion.
Okay, so the trip's been a disaster so far.
And it gets worse here in this fourth section as they're traveling to Moab. Even Moses has a moment of rebellion and is disqualified from entering the promised land. Then there's another rebellion among the people that results in this snake attack. And what makes all these rebellions even worse is that every step of the way, God has been providing. He's been offering forgiveness. He's been giving them food and water and this crazy stuff called manna.
Yeah, what is that stuff?
Yeah, no idea. But in spite of all this, they keep complaining, and they say that they wish they had died in slavery in Egypt.
If I was God, I would just give up on these guys.
You would think. But that's what makes this story in the final section so surprising. Israel has just arrived in Moab, and the king of Moab, he's freaked out that this huge group of people is traveling through his land. So he hires this pagan sorcerer named Balaam to pronounce curses on them.
This guy means business.
Yeah, and so Balaam, he says, okay, I'm going to pray to the Hebrew God, and let's see what happens. And three different times, he attempts to curse them, but each time he finds that he can utter only blessing. Most surprising is the last blessing, where he prophesies that out of Israel will rise a victorious king. And this king is somehow going to be connected to God's promise to Abraham to bless all nations through this family. So here's Israel, rebelling down in the camp, totally unaware that up in the hills, God is protecting and even blessing them.
The book ends here in Moab. Israel's getting ready to go into the promised land. They count up everyone again, just like at the beginning. They're leaving the old generation behind, including Moses.
But before they leave Moses, he gives them his last words of warning and wisdom. And that speech is what the next book, Deuteronomy, is all about.
Now you've been introduced to the book of Numbers, okay? So, I know there's a lot in there. And my hope and prayer is that in the next few weeks, you guys, using this overview, will actually brave the world of reading through Numbers systematically, starting from chapter 1 and going through all the chapters. And we are going, the teachers during this series, we're going to try and highlight different aspects of stuff that happens to the nation of Israel as they relate to God. And as we pause and dive into different sections, we're hopefully going to be pulling out truths that are going to be really relevant to kind of defining a season, okay? Now, we ask the question, this journey from Mount Sinai, where Moses has received the Ten Commandments and has come down and is doing business now with the people. They have just come out of slavery for 400 years. They're free. They have seen God perform miraculous things, like parting the Red Sea to allow them to cross through. And they're here. This entire generation has seen the miraculous hand of God. This generation knows that God sent plague after plague after plague 10 times to their oppressors, the Egyptians. And they have seen time and time again God do amazing miraculous things, right? So you would think all of them really know that they're dealing with a God that can do literally anything, that can take his supernatural hand and shift the trajectory of nations and dynasties. They have all borne witness to this firsthand. And yet, what's interesting is that their journey from Mount Sinai to the Promised Land is only 250 feet away, or 250 miles away. Okay. Now, if you think about that, back in the day, based on the number of people, and there were hundreds of thousands of people in this group, the nation of Israel has been marching through, even to herd all those people through that 250 miles, they could have probably did it in about 2 weeks to get from there to the Promised Land. Okay? If they're a little bit slower, maybe 4 weeks. If they're really slow, maybe 6 weeks. But yet, it takes them 40 years. Okay? Now you have to stop and think about that. If this season was supposed to be fairly brief, all of these guys saw God's hand of faithfulness, so they should have had no problem saying, God, you have backed us up every step of the way. You know, this journey should only take about 2 to 6 weeks. Let's go there. Let's get this done. Let's claim our Promised Land. You would think after 400 years of oppression and being delivered, this short period of time should be cake. The season should be short, joyful, full of promise, excitement, speedy, efficient, right? But it takes 40 years. If you think about 40 years, think about your lives for a second. Think about the fact that the psalmist, David, will often refer to around age 25 as the end of youth and as the beginning of adulthood. 25 roughly is when we enter into the working world on average, right? And when do we retire in this country? About 65. How many years is that? From 25 it's 40. 40 is a very symbolic time in the church, in scriptural history. Whether you think about the 40 days Jesus spent in the desert, whether you think about the 40 days the rain came down during Noah's time, 40 is a very symbolic number, and it remains so today. Mm-hmm. We have 40 years, roughly, of an active working career in our adult life, where most people will say from the age of 25 to 65 is when most of us actually work, earn an income. It's the prime of our lives, and then everything after 65 is a different season, right? We're not actively working with that same intensity. And so think about this. A lot happens in 40 years. This was supposed to take them 2 to 6 weeks, but it's taking them 40 years. Why? Why? If you look at the Hebrew word for the book of Numbers, I want you guys to say this word with me. It's on your handout. Midbar. Can you say this? Midbar. Okay, and it comes from the word, a verb, lehadbir. Lehadbir. Can you say lehadbir?
Lehadbir.
If there are Hebrew scholars who can pronounce it better, please chime in. Lehadbir. And the literal translation of this is to pastor one's flock. So if you think about the word numbers, and you look at the original Hebrew meaning, and you look at the verb derivative, it actually translates to pasture one's flock. Think about that for a second. Now, if you think about life back in that day, you know, the shepherds, they would basically take their sheep out of the cages and they would go into the rural countryside to feed the sheep, right? And resources might be sparse, but it would be sufficient. And I want to propose to you today that just maybe God was wanting to pasture and shepherd his people during this time in the wilderness. And maybe he knew what he was doing when he let them wander and graze for 40 years. Because he knew they needed that time. That you could not hit a fast forward button and go through it in 2 weeks. But he needed them to go through and be pastured and shepherded for 40 years. The name of the book of Numbers bears that meaning. Now we know that there are 3 major places where all the action really happens in the book of Numbers, right? The first location, as you saw from the video, happens right in the Mount Sinai area. Then they travel and they come to the other wilderness in an area called Paran. Then they travel some more and they finally come to the plains of Moab, which is right on the edge of the Jordan River that overlooks the Promised Land. These are the 3 major places where all the action happens. And what we're going to do in the next few weeks is we're going to kind of march you through in a chronological order of the action moments that happen, the teachable moments where we can learn from stuff that goes on in the first plane, the second plane, so over by Mount Sinai, and then in Paran, and then finally on the plains of Moab. Now, I guess all of us came to this class wondering, well, the title says, Living Every Season Fully. I hope I get pearls out of this class about what I can do to live my present season fully. Right? Did you guys all think that in some way or another? And I hope at the end of the next few weeks, you have grasped those pearls, and the Lord deposits that. But where I want to start is actually talking about 3 things that actually can really ruin a season that God has for you. 3 things that can suck the joy, suck the fruit, suck the promise, suck the blessing that God has for you in your unique seasons, okay? Well, and they all come from the word dis. You know, when we were young, I don't know if you guys were in grade school, you know, if somebody spoke disrespectfully to you, you know, you'd always say, man, this person just dissed me. Or I just dissed the teacher, or I just dissed my friend. Like that, the word dis was used in a slang word. But actually, the root word dis has actually made it into our English language and literature, and now it's officially means to speak disrespectfully or to criticize somebody. The word, the derivative dis, D-I-S. So we're going to talk about 3 things that the nation of Israel goes through that I would submit to you actually pulls away from what God had intended for them. You know, had they not gone to these 3 displaces, they may have actually been able to get to the Promised Land in 2 to 4 to 6 weeks. But because they chose to dwell in the valley of the disses, they were stuck in the wilderness for 40 years. We're going to talk about the first dis today, disillusionment. Next week, we are going to look at disobedience. And the third week, we're going to look at disbelief, okay? And here is the, if you get nothing out of today, I want you to remember this one thing. And I want you to think about it because I don't even know if I've actually heard many people preaching or teaching on this one idea, okay? And I want you to consider this very, very carefully. It is very possible, and actually God says it is very possible, for you to miss out on the blessings that God has for you in this season. And yet God's purposes will continue to carry on with or without you. Think about that. It is very possible for you on a personal level to miss out on all the blessings that God has for you in your season, even though God's purposes for His church will continue to march forward. You are not going to stop God's purposes. But you can easily miss out on the blessings that this season has for you. God's ship is going to keep going forward. And whether you get the blessings or not is actually entirely dependent on the choices you make. Have you heard a lot of teaching on this? You have to really, really think about this and consider this. In your 20s, in your 30s, in your 40s, in your 60s, in your 70s, you can miss out on the things that God has intended specifically for you. I'm not necessarily even talking about salvation, because I do believe once you are truly saved, you are saved. We can talk about that at a different time. But I'm talking about all the seasonal blessings that are inherent for you. Okay, what do I mean by this? Let me give you some examples from my life and how disillusionment gripped me over my life. What do I mean by disillusionment, first of all? Well, we define disillusionment, if you look on the second page, as a feeling of disappointment resulting from the discovery that something is not as good as one believed it to be. All right? Maybe you're thinking to yourself, I'm not disillusioned. I'm pretty realistic. I know what I was getting into. I know the territory and the season I was coming into. Let me tell you how it played itself out for me. I'm going to hit the rewind button of my memory all the way back to when I was maybe 3 years old. And that my earliest memories of my childhood are from when I was about 3, I think. And I remember as a 3-year-old thinking that, oh, you know what? This season is horrible because I can look up and I can see the foods that my parents are eating that I can't really eat. They just let me lick stuff. And I want to actually eat these things. And I feel like they're just teasing me. I can't wait to get to the next season. I appreciated the fact that I could poop in my Pampers still, that I was not potty trained. I saw that as a convenience, but I still remember. This is probably too much TMI, but these were my early memories. But I wanted to get to age 5, and then I got to age 5, and I was still in Sri Lanka at the time. That's the island nation that I was born in, and I thought to myself at age 5. Because that's also around the time when the Civil War broke out in our country. You know, I remember thinking around the age of 3 to 5, you know, as a young kid, I see it in my daughter now, and I want adventure. I'm just so tired and bored of just sitting in my, I want adventure. And then age 5 came, and all of a sudden the Civil War breaks out in our country, and my life for the next 2 years was full of adventure. It was full of running and hiding in bunkers as bombshells were dropping. It was full of sitting in a classroom and spray bullets coming and all of us ducking under our table to make sure we don't get hit. And it was full of coming home on the bicycle with my dad and all of a sudden random crossfire happening. And our job was for my dad and I to kind of duck and hide in bushes and while the bad guys from both sides were trying to kill each other, our goal and our mission was to survive. And as a 7, 5, 6-year-old kid, man, this is what I thought I wanted, right? And now I got that. And then the reality of that season started to hit me as I would walk into my classroom the next day and all my friends who I had known for the last few months were no longer there. And I thought to myself, you know, life was a lot better when my biggest problem was wanting to eat what my dad and mom wanted to. And then I found myself craving for security and a peaceful place. And so then I come to my version of when I'm 7 and we're in the U.S. And I'm a 7-year-old kid who feels like I'm completely out of my element. I hardly know a couple words of English. And I'm trying to make it in second grade, sitting through ESL classes. And even though I had wanted security and peace, which we had here now, I soon found myself thinking, you know what, I just don't belong here. At least when I was running from bullets in my country, I could call that my country, but now I feel like a total immigrant who can't even speak the language, right? And I thought that season before was, you know, so much better. Suddenly I had forgotten about all the atrocities of war and all the atrocities of being a second-class citizen or living under oppression and living under fear of life or death every day. All of that seemed to grow strangely dim. And then I got to my 10-year-old self. And my 10-year-old self said, okay, I think I got this English language down and I'm slowly adjusting to life here as an immigrant. I won a spelling bee or two, so I've proven that I can compete with people here, and maybe I do belong. And things were slowly getting better, and then my 15-year-old self came. But I remember I used to always be a bratty kid, and I would fight with my brother and cause my mom to cry, and I was just really naughty. ADHD kid who, now thinking back, I probably had undiagnosed ADHD, so I would fidget all the time, I would move all the time, I would get into trouble, just doing useless things to annoy my brother and causing grief upon my parents. And, you know, I used to think, my parents would just leave me alone. They would just leave me alone, don't bother me at all, I would be much happier. And, you know, my mom used to once in a while tell me, you know, you just bring me so much sadness when you fight with your brother. One day when I'm gone, you're gonna know how much you will miss me and how my words will stick with you. And then I get to my 15-year-old self and she gets diagnosed with cancer and she dies in 4 months. And now all of a sudden, I remembered her words, and I remembered thinking, man, I wanted my mom to leave me alone, and now all I want is for her to just hold me one more time. That was me at 15. And now all I want is a normal family. I'd be happy just getting a meal. I'd be happy just not us going on. I'd be happy being dirt poor. All I just want is my mom, because we don't know how to function without your mother. Mm-hmm. And I know for some of you in this room, that story is really real. I lost my mom when I was 15. My brother was 9. And my 18-year-old self, I was getting ready to go to school and go off to college. And you know, I wanted to leave and start fresh, and then I found myself in Rochester, New York, and I looked back on the season before and I thought to myself, no, now I'm homesick. Mm-hmm. I'm 3,000 miles away from my family who just went through devastation, and maybe I left too soon and life was so much better when I was with my family. And then I was in college and med school and thinking, man, studying to be a doctor is taking so long. I just want to start making money, right? I want that responsibility. It's nice that I get to wake up at 11 in the morning, but man, I want to start paying off my debts and making money. And then I started working as a doctor, And I started working 120-hour weeks, and I said,
what?
I would love to be able to wake up at 11 a.m. again. I would love to have weekends off. I would love to be able to come to church not having worked a 40-hour shift. When I first started coming to VCF, I would come in my blue scrubs. I would work from Friday night to Sunday morning straight, and I would drive from Harbor UCLA, and I would just come over here after 45 minutes of driving, sit through, try not to fall asleep, make sense of the sermon, and then I would go home and I would sleep. And I would think to myself, basic things like sleep and being able to eat properly were luxury. So I shared, and then when I was single, I thought to myself, you know, I'm 36, I'm not married, I don't have kids, all my friends have passed that plateau, and I'm the only one left behind. Life would be so much better if I was married. And I was 36 and I was not married. And then I did get married. And then we thought to ourselves, we had 3 years, my wife and I, to ourselves, and we thought, life is grand, but you know what? If we had children, life would be so much more joyful. It would just complete us in a different way. And so our first one came, and then our second one came. And now we think, you know those days when we were married, when we could sleep till 6 at least in the morning, when we didn't have to wake up 5-6 times a night to change diapers, when we weren't chronically tired all the time. Those days are long gone, right? And so in every season of my life, I share these funny examples with you because in every season, I have always found myself wrestling with looking back in the season that I came from and saying, oh, the grass was greener back then. Life was better back then. And also looking forward to the next season and saying, you know what, if I can just get out of this season, if I can be on survival mode and hit that survival button and hit this landmark and get out of this season, then the next season will be a land of milk and honey and everything will be wonderful. And what I've learned after living a meager 41 years is that every season of my life, I have always found myself looking back and remembering the previous season as being more glorious than it actually was, and also looking forward to the season in front and thinking it will be glorious than it actually panned out to be with my concept of what I thought greener pastures would look like. The past and the future always looked more green than the dirt brown patch I was on right then and there. Okay, and so when I look at the nation of Israel, I'm tempted first. I think we're all tempted to look at these band of people and think to ourselves, why would God pick these dysfunctional group through whom he was going to redeem all of mankind? Why did he choose these people that would just complain and whine and they would rebel time and time again? Ah, God could have done so much better. And then I look at myself in the mirror.
Looks like me.
They look just like me. They look just like me. And if God can redeem them, then I've got hope. And so, it's in this space, with 45 minutes left this evening, that we're going to actually dive into the place where we're going to learn a little bit about what disillusionment, what the first dis towards God did to the nation of Israel and how they responded. So let me walk you through the first 10, 11 chapters. Basically, this is what happens. So the book of Numbers, it gets its name, right? Because both in the beginning of the book and in the end of the book, God tells Moses, hey, Moses, get your people together, count the number of people from do a census. Count everybody in the 12 tribes of Israel. Specifically, I want you to count all the men who are over 20 years of age. and so that you can form an army out of them and get it from all 12 tribes. And that number came out to about 603,550, to be exact. Okay? So that was the army that came of men over the age of 20 from all these 12 tribes. So God first said, scope the land, look at your resources, figure out who's a part of our clan here, who are the fighting soldiers, they numbered about 600,000, and organize your clans and figure out who they are and number them. Know your resources. And then God says in the first few chapters, hey, let the tabernacle and the meeting tent and where my presence is going to dwell, build that in the middle, and everything should surround that. So let the priests and certain tribes form, four of the tribes form around here, and the other eight further out, and everything should centrally revolve around my presence, right? And God kind of lays out the foundational geographic structure for them. And then he gives people, you know, Moses is a main character here, right? And his brother Aaron and their sister Miriam, they're key players here. And he tells Moses to work with Aaron and his sons who are the priests, and he gives, and God tells Moses, hey, organize these people, the Levites, in a special way, because they will be helping Aaron to kind of administer all of the priestly rituals. And God dishes out some other codes, like the Nazirite code, and gives other laws and commandments for how they should live and carry themselves. And the really cool thing is, if you looked at the way God organizes the people, he says, Scripture actually says that during the daytime, there was a cloud that would hover from the center. And God's presence was there. And at nighttime, the cloud would change into fire. Okay, and this would be emanating from the center of their campsite. And God's presence was there. And when that cloud moved during the daytime, or the fire at nighttime, that was the signal for this entire band of people, hundreds and thousands of people, to move, for all 12 clans to move. And they were to wait until they saw the cloud move by day or the fire by night. And so that's basically the essence of the first 11 chapters. That's what goes on in Mount Sinai area for like the first year and 2 months in this 40-year journey. Okay? And then in the second month of that second year, all of this happens. First 10, 11 chapters in about a year span. And then we move into the second year, and all of a sudden, the cloud starts to move, right? And so, as you saw in the video, everybody starts to follow the cloud. And they move into this area called Paran, the wilderness of Paran. And this is where we're going to dive into the two verses we're going to look at today. Turn with me, if you have your Bibles, to Numbers chapter 11, verse 1. Okay? And somebody read this for me. Can someone read Numbers 11, 1? It's actually up here. Someone read it out.
Carissa. Now the people complained about their hardships in the hearing of the Lord, and when he heard them, his anger was aroused. Then fire from the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp.
Okay. Now I want you to understand when the people started complaining. They literally started complaining. Scripture actually says, if you read the context, 3 days, 72 hours from the time they started moving. Alright, so I mean, this is not even a week yet, but these people who have seen God's faithfulness for so long in so many consistent ways, 3 days into the journey, they start complaining. And you know what they say? Let's look at Numbers 11, 4 through 6. Okay, this is their first major grievance. Rabble, by the way, means like a rowdy crowd. Okay, so the rabble with them began to crave other food. And again, the Israelites started wailing and said, if only we had meat to eat. And look at what they remember about their past life. They don't remember the fact that they were in shackles. They don't remember the fact that they were beaten every day into slavery, or that they were working endless hours each night helping Pharaoh build his pyramids and other structures, and that they had no rights and no system of justice, but they were at the mercy of the Egyptians for 400 years, where people would die and they would get very minimal rations. They forget all of that, but this is what they remember in the context of their suffering now. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. At no cost.
It was free.
It was free. All of a sudden, slavery went out the door because the fish from the Nile River came to them at no cost. Wow. At no cost. Also, don't forget the cucumbers, and the melons, the luscious melons, and the leeks, and the onions, and that garlic. This is what they remember. But now, they say, all of a sudden they come from the buffets at Luxor to having lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna. And for those of you guys, nobody really knows what manna is. I've read so many commentaries on what manna is, but basically back, what the Lord did was, as the dew would set in the evening hours in their campsites, they would get, do you guys know what coriander seeds look like? Have you ever seen coriander seeds?
Yeah.
They're really small, tiny. But it would fall, and actually the book goes into a detailed description of what manna looks like, but they would take this dew that would fall from heaven, and they would make like cakes and bake it, and they would eat it. And this was their food. It was enough to sustain them. But they're thinking about the melons and the onions and the garlic and the fish while they were slaves in Egypt. And they're not satisfied by the manna that God is giving them. Even though God's resources are scarce, it's sufficient. It's sufficient for them, but they are not okay with that. And verse 18 later says, the Lord heard you when you wailed. If only we had meat to eat, we were better off in Egypt. Now the Lord will give you meat for a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and you loathe it because you have rejected the Lord. The Lord actually gives them quail. Scripture tells us, as you read, it's a really cool description, that the quail would sort of start to descend. God would cause winds to bring the quail into the outskirts of the camp. And in the evenings, each person would go and be able to bring this quail down that would come down because of the winds. And each of them had plenty to eat, so much so that the quail would come out of their nostrils. Like that, so much so that they began to loathe it. Right? God gave them what they wanted. And so this their disillusionment got them into this space. They remembered not the suffering in Egypt, not the slavery in Egypt. And maybe some of you here today, you're believers, and you've come to know God's saving hand. But while you're thankful for that, you think about the cost of being a Christian and in this phase of your life. And you ask yourself the question, but I feel like I'm living without so many things. My life, the life that I knew before, yes, I have this salvation. Yes, my eternal future is secured, but I feel like I'm living without so much that I had, the pleasures that I had in my former life. Maybe you're there today. And then a second interesting thing happens. We move on to, so first the nation, they complain about the food. And then, so they're kind of looking at themselves and their condition. And then in Numbers 12, if you read the next chapter over, something else interesting happens. Moses' sister Miriam and his brother Aaron, chapter 12, verse 1 says, they began to talk against Moses because of his Cushite wife. For he had married a Cushite. Has the Lord spoken only through Moses? Sibling jealousy. They asked, hasn't he also spoken through us? And the Lord heard this. And verse 9 later says, the anger of the Lord burned against them, and he left them. So, while in chapter 11, they are disillusioned with their current state, because they thought the season of traveling would be so much different than what it was. Now, they start to question the Lord's leadership structure, and they start to look around at blessings even amongst themselves. And you know, here are Moses' brother and sister who are supposed to be his confidant, the, you know, part of his inner circle, the people that he can lean on. And what do they do in front of everybody else? They're questioning his leadership. They are saying, you know, does God only speak to you, Moses? Surely he speaks to us as well. Why should your voice be higher than ours? Right? So they begin to question the way the Lord sets up leadership structure. And they ask themselves the question deep inside, well, others are blessed. Moses is blessed. Why not me? Why am I not chosen? Right? And I think this is really important for us as we break up into small groups to talk about this a little bit. I gave you some questions to ponder for this evening. And I want us to really ask this question. Given your present state right now, your season in life, in what ways do you think your life was better in a past season? Okay? For those of you who are married, maybe you're thinking, and I'm going through a rough patch in my marriage right now, and I remember how free I used to be when I was single, where I didn't need to check in with anybody, when I could stay up as late as I want, when I didn't have to run back home, when I didn't have responsibilities, when I could do the dishes when I wanted to, take out the trash when I needed to. For those of you who are parents, maybe you're thinking, you know what? I remember those wonderful days when I could sleep in, when I didn't have to respond to a hungry mouth all the time. You know, and maybe for those of you who are students right now, you're thinking to yourself, or young people working, man, it was, as much as I used to whine, it was so much better when I was living under mom and dad's roof, because at the end of the day, they took care of all the bills. And for those of you who are maybe in an older season, you're thinking to yourself, you know, I remember when I used to have the strength to be able to run and move and have endless amounts of energy, and now I just get tired so quickly. And maybe you think about a past season and you think life was so much greener back then. And you had thought that this season was supposed to be better than how it's working itself out. And that leads to my second question. Today, this evening, October 24th, 2019, how do I feel disappointed with God in my current seasonal state? You know, you look at other people and you like if in the first question, you like the Egyptians, or you like the nation of Israel, you're thinking about how good life used to be in Egypt. In the second question, you like Miriam and Aaron, you look at Moses or other people you know and say, well, that person is blessed. Why not me? Why not me? Hasn't God spoken to me? Am I not chosen by God? Shouldn't I be getting married right now? Shouldn't I be having children right now? Shouldn't I be... I'm widowed and God should have brought another person for me to marry by now. God should have gotten me that promotion by now. God should have gotten me that degree by now. God should have gotten me that break by now, because I saw it happen to my cousin and my sister and my brother-in-law. They're blessed. By now, I figured I already would have been dot, dot, dot. Fill in the blank. As you guys get into your small groups, I hope that you feel the safety and the security to kind of open up and discuss those two questions. Mm-hmm. And end the evening by maybe praying for one another. Mm-hmm. And asking, what can I start doing this evening to break the spirit of disillusionment towards God? Because you saw how in both those examples, it invokes God's anger. Because the people are telling God that you're not as good as we thought you were. How do we break that spirit of disillusionment? So let's break up into our small groups. Spend about half an hour. And we'll end with a time of prayer.